A2RIW, and at this time it's in the check set. We've already got checked in KC1SAM, W-H-R-Y-Y, and N2EO. You guys who know the main purpose of the TechNet is education, the curious radio amateurs gather at this time. The clan gathers to teach each other wireless techniques and discuss their favorite subjects. Their radios and their antennas and their transmission lines and so on, how to make it all work well. Okay, other than Sam and Joe and Rich, is there anyone else that wants to check in tonight? Because you do have a question or a comment. Just call it as a name at this time, K2RIW.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Lou. Okay, we had a double that time, WB2GXM. And Lou, what's your call letters that covered up?
NY2H.
Okay, we got Lou. So we got Sam, Joe, Rich, and Lou. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. The TechNet is broken up into three sections. First section is questions and answers. The second section is Roy, AC2GS, gives us the space, science talk, and then it's followed by WS2N, Paul, with the space report. Okay, I know you wanted to talk to me earlier, Sam, so KC1SAM, K2RIW, go ahead, Sam.
KC1SAM. Yeah, I wanted to get back to you on something we spoke about last night, which is really outside the TechNet, but as long as we're here, that Toron that you mentioned, and we were talking about dog food and cat food, it is in dry food, Purina Complete. I went through a couple of bags, the labels on the bags, my daughter buys different stuff, and it's in the Purina Complete, so it does come in dry food form. And, of course, it is available, like you were saying, in wet food with basically meat products and fish and so forth. So it is available. It's a conditional amino acid. Now, we need some, too, but you probably get ours. So that was really it. I wanted to just get back to you because we were chatting about it last night. Back over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. Yeah, Turin is a vital product that's needed for cats. There are people who will sometimes feed wet dog food to their cats, and because the dog food might not contain the Turin product or enough of it, the cats can develop some problems because of that. Okay, Joe is next. W2RYY, K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick, W2RYY. This question has to do with circulators. I've seen some on different types of isolated panels. Most of the ones I've come across in the past couple of years have capacitor trimmers for adjusting the forward loss. You can sort of trim that a little bit, but also the return loss frequency, where you get the best return loss or deepest dip. But I've come by other ones in the past that were, I guess, fairly a good number of years old, maybe 25, 35 years old, that have no adjustments on them, and the return loss is flat across the whole band, but it's about half of what you currently get nowadays. But how do the ones work that have piston trimmers on them? They look like piston trimmer type of capacitors. What is that, some sort of LC circuit built into the isolator as well?
Yeah, an isolator is a peculiar object. If you take one apart, you'll find out it's got a printed circuit in there, which has got three input-output connectors. It's a Y-shaped object. Every 120 degrees is an input or output connector. And that printed circuit, it's actually strip line, upper and lower ground plane with a conductor in the center. And that ferrite material that pancakes the strip line semiconductor above and below also has biasing magnets on it. And the right kind of ferrite material with a magnetic field has a frequency selectivity quality to it, and also obeys a property called gyrotropy. It's a fancy way of saying that the signal that flows around in a clockwise manner and the signal that flows around the circle in a counterclockwise manner have two different velocities of propagation because of the ferrite and the magnetic field. And when you set it up just right, you put a signal into port number one, all the signal comes out of port number two, and nothing comes out of port number three where you put a termination, so the signal flows clockwise, so to speak. Put a signal into port number two, it'll come out of port number three, and port number one can be terminated, so it's always clockwise. And in the counterclockwise direction, they call it isolation. When you adjust the magnetic field and the impedance matching of input and output connectors, when you adjust them so that you get the best isolation in the counterclockwise manner, automatically you're getting the best insertion loss in the forward manner. So by tuning magnetic fields and impedance matching, you can take an isolator that was, say, for instance, designed for 11 gigahertz and move it down to 10 gigahertz by decreasing the magnetic field. There's a direct relationship between strength of magnetic field on your external magnets that are biasing those two hockey puck plates in there, and stronger magnetic field moves it to a higher frequency, very similar to the way a Yig tune filter works. So people who buy circulators for the wrong frequency, you might buy one for 12 gigs and you can tune it down to 10 gigs, for instance, by adjusting the impedance matching. That variable capacitor is one of the impedance matching characteristics. So it's a combination of magnetic field and impedance matching that when you get the best isolation on your favorite frequency, you have the least amount of insertion loss. That's about as much as I know about those. They're very handy, and there are various designs that are more broadband than others. There's also something called a peripheral mode isolator. If you Google those words, peripheral mode isolator, you'll see a slightly different kind of design that uses some of the same characteristics. But Joe, this is far from the whole story. You go to the right articles on circulators. Some of them are very technically written, but good information is there if you're willing to spend the time. W2LYY, K2LY, up here in the Tech Man.
Question set.
Okay, very good. I'll have to go on the internet and read up on that. Whatever I didn't catch the word you said, I can just review it on the tape next week or a couple of days from now. I think it said peripheral. I think was the word, something else. But I'll check it out and read up. I was just curious about it. As I said, some of the answers I come by that don't have any tuning oil are used for telephone company type of installations in a 450 megahertz band. I was kind of amazed that they had only like 30-35 dB return loss looking from the port number two back towards the load, but it was not specific at one frequency. Of course, a very, very wide band, like it was about 80 or 100 megs worth of frequency band. And it's kind of interesting because if you think about it, how it works, if you get one specifically tuned on your transmit frequency, so any energy in your transmit frequency goes to load, what do you do about energy that's out of band, like maybe 5, 10, 15 megs away that have to come through your transmitter filters and comes back into that isolator? Does that still go into the dummy load, or does it react differently because it's not tuned for it?
Yeah, Wes recognized. We'll get to you in a second, Wes. The circulators, almost every single repeater that's located on the top of a popular site, like say, for instance, Glen Oaks, where there are multiple repeaters there, by definition, every single repeater must have a circulator going to the antenna. That means that the transmitter output of the repeater goes to the antenna, and signals coming back down from the antenna come into the circulator in the reverse mode, end up in the dummy load. You have to do that because any signals coming back down your antenna of a repeater that hit the transmitter, any signals that get through to the transmitter, because the transmitter final stage is a very nonlinear device. It's a mixer. When signals are fed backwards into it, it'll take all of the signals that are on your site, like Glen Oaks, mix them all together into various products, and therefore all kinds of spurious new signals get generated. So there must be a circulator on the output of every repeater, protecting the transmitter from any reverse flow signals. The signals that are out of band, so to speak. By the way, Isolation of 35 dB is a very good circulator. 20 dB is the threshold of a good one. 35 dB and above is getting into the infinite mode, a very high-tuned one. I have seen a circulator that had isolation of 55 dB when very carefully tuned to a particular frequency. So if you really spend the time, you can tune them very, very well. To do that, you've got to make sure you've got the good 50 ohm loads everywhere. Otherwise, you're tuning it for a particular environment. Let me drop. But if the signal is arriving back at the circulator on the wrong frequency, because the impedance match to the circulator may not be exactly 50 ohms, you're going to get a little bit of reflection right at the front door of the circulator, so to speak. Although an awful lot of the signal that's on the wrong frequency still ends up in the demi load. And in the case of our transmitter that had a failed antenna recently, where the transmitter was putting out, say, 50 watts, and the antenna was highly reflective, all of that 50 watts was ending up coming back down from the reflection from the antenna into that dummy load, and the dummy load was running very hot. All 50 watts out of the transmitter, so to speak, was eventually going into the dummy load. So the word you were looking for is peripheral mode, M-O-D-E, peripheral mode isolator, is another style of isolator, another design concept. The majority of them, though, are this Y-shaped object. So there's lots of articles on the subject. Back to you for a final on that before we go over to Wes. W-2-R-Y-Y, T-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Peripheral mode, now it's drilled into my head. I won't forget this. I won't forget it. Okay, thanks for the info, Dick. Carry on, W-2-R-Y-Y.
Yeah, it sounds like Wes had a circulator question now. N2XJN, K2RIW, good, Wes.
I'm more general in this matter. Now, we were talking about ferrite and air, and you were talking that in different materials we have different propagation, whether it's by word difference or in propagation. You were talking about slow wave interaction.
I don't know if I would call it a slow wave. The right kind of ferrite material, when biased with a magnetic field, gets tuned to a particular frequency, and that frequency, by the way, is directly proportional. Double the magnetic field, and you exactly double the frequency it's tuned to. It's a linear relationship going all the way down to zero as far as the graft is concerned, although below a certain frequency it doesn't operate correctly. But the right kind of ferrite material with a magnetic field biasing it, a fixed magnet flowing through it, so to speak, I think it's at right angles, obeys a property called gyrotropy. Gyrotropy means that the signal flowing through the strip line using the ferrite as dielectric material, the dielectric material has normal velocity of propagation, so to speak. 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant is your velocity of propagation. So it has one velocity for a signal that flows clockwise and a slightly different velocity for the signal that flows counterclockwise. That's what gives us this selectivity, where the signal going into port number one comes out of port number two, the signal going to port number two comes out of port number three, and so on. The signal you put into port number two, the isolated port would be port number one, and nothing would flow there when you have it tuned correctly. So all the signals flow clockwise, no signals flow counterclockwise in the three-port isolator. So that's called gyrotropy, very slight difference of velocity of propagation. I don't think it's called slow wave, but there I'm not sure. Over to US, K2RIW.
The polarization of light, if we could compare to the electromagnetic wave, incident is up on the grading. It is defined by orientation of its electric and magnetic fields that is relative to the plane of incidence, where the plane of the incidence is defined as two vectors, where one is in grading normal, which is the normal vector, and the other one is the vector of propagation. Should I apply that formula to that what you said?
I don't know. And by the way, I think there is an optical equivalent for a circulator, which can be used with fiber optic communication. I think there is such a thing. And there's also a way with fiber optics where you can make an amplifier that amplifies the fiber optic signal. So, you guys know as much as I knew about circulators, and there's not much more I can contribute to that, Wes. I'm going to go over to the next person, which was Rich. N2EO, K2IW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine. Fine, Dick. N2EO. I have a problem with the my HF kilowatt amplifier that's come back. The problem is, originally, when before I had put down the shield, the magnetic shield, whatever you want to call it, on top of the amplifier, the SWR meter was slowly rise. It was not SWR. It was just whatever you want to call it. Now the same problem exists. All I did was change the input cable from the radio to the antenna to the input of the amplifier, and the problem is back. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, over the last few months, Rich, each time you turn on your kilowatt amplifier, you were burning up capacitors on the antenna tuner, creating all kinds of grief on the directional coupler that indicates standing wave ratio and so on. So until all of the problems with your barefoot exciter, your 100-watt exciter going into the antenna, through the antenna tuner, until those are all ironed out correctly, I think for the time being you should back off on that amplifier because something is improper, and each time you use it, damage occurs. From what you've described, I don't have anything that I can add to your description. Let's see if anyone else has any suggestions for Rich N2EO. If you have any suggestions for his kilowatt amplifier, give us your call letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet. Yeah, from what you're describing, it sounds like that directional coupler assembly, which I believe Andy has had to repair recently. I hope that damage hasn't occurred to it again because of it being overloaded by a high standing wave ratio load and high power output. When you're using that amplifier, you've got to sneak up on it slowly, Rich. In other words, apply the power to it slowly and make sure you're getting good readings before you go to higher power output and do damage again. Those are my suggestions, Rich. N2EO, K2IW in the TechNet.
I've snuck up on it. Low power. For a while, it was working fine. Anyway, that's it again.
Good luck with that repair operation and analysis operation, Rich. Next person on the list was another Rich, WB2GXM. Go right ahead, Rich, K2IW in the TechNet.
Electrically 100 feet of RG8X coax cable, and I take 25 feet of it right in the middle and wind it around a form to create a common mode choke. Do I now still have electrically 100 feet of coax, or do I have 75 feet or something else? WB2GXM.
Believe it or not, the answer is yes and yes. As far as the signal flowing down the center of the coax is concerned, that center conductor to outer shield, if a piece of cable is 100 feet long, then you've got 100 feet of cable. You've got if 100 feet of cable with a velocity factor of let's say 70%, will act 1 over 70%, maybe it's 1.414, so it'll act like 140 feet of air line, so to speak. So the signal flowing down the center of the cable does not know what you've done to the outside. You've wrapped it around a form. As far as the signal flowing down the outside of the cable is concerned, you've got an unbalanced antenna that's launching some current on the outside shield of the coax. It now sees the first X number of feet of coax before your coil, then the coil itself represents an inductor. And now the signal that tries to flow beyond that has problems. If you've made the right number of microhenries of inductance so that it has an inductive reactance of, say, 1,000 ohms, then the signal flowing down the outside of the cable hits that 1,000 ohm series inductor, and very little of it flows any further. The average person who uses a poor man ballon by wrapping it will put that coil, the wrapping, as close to the antenna as possible so that any signal flowing down the cable doesn't get a chance to become an extension of the antenna. The portion of the cable that's got current flowing through it becomes an extension of your antenna and can change the tuning of the antenna. So for that reason, the average person will put that choke as close to the antenna as he can get it. Maybe that helps some, Rich. WP2GXM, HRIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, this only becomes a factor. There was an article in QST a while back about using a particular configuration of transmission lines to broaden the SWR of an 80-meter dipole. And it was a quarter wavelength of 75-ohm coax out of the transmitter coupled to either one wavelength of RG8 or half wavelength of RG8 paralleled. And putting a choke in that, putting a poor man's choke in that configuration, as I understand it, will not change the behavior of this broadbanding, since the inside conductor doesn't know what's going on. WB2GXM.
Yes, I agree with that, Rich. The inside of the cable doesn't know what's going on in the outside world. The center conductor is completely shielded from the outside world by the outer conductor of the coax cable. So what you do on the outside doesn't matter as far as the signal flowing down the center is concerned. However, the signal flowing down the center, when it comes to the end of the cable, will eventually see your antenna. And the antenna itself has either a good or a bad impedance match, which means some signal can be reflected back down the center of the cable if the impedance match is poor. And the antenna might have some unbalanced characteristics where it's, because of the imbalance, it's launching some signal on the outside of the cable. In that case, the amount of cable to the choke, the length of that cable, and whether or not it becomes part of the tuning assembly and part of the antenna, that can be used in your favor. There's a large number of ways of designing antennas and tweaking devices you put on the connection to the antenna to improve performance, or if you do it wrong, worsen the performance. So there's two separate signals to consider, the one on the inside and the one on the outside. And once you realize the shielding characteristics of the cable, you know how the one going down the center doesn't know anything has happened until it hits the antenna and does or doesn't see a good impedance match at that frequency. Over to you, Rich, WB2GXM, HRIW in the TechNet.
Question answered. Thank you, Dick. K2RW in the group, WB2GXM, clear.
For a couple more words here, Rich, the broadbanding of the 80-meter dipole, before the broadbanding technique, I presume the dipole was like a few percent wide, and with that broadbanding technique, how much wider did the 80-meter dipole become, if you remember, Rich? Go ahead.
This article states that across the entire 80-meter band, which would be 3.5 to 4 megahertz, the SWR never rises above 2.1. It forms kind of a double dip from 3.5 to 4 megahertz. This is specifically using the quarter wavelength of 75-ohm coax that would be RG11 or equivalent out of the transmitter, then coupled to one wavelength at 3.75 megahertz of 50-ohm coax with the RG213 or RG8X. Or the alternative, one half wave of 50-ohm coax paralleled out of the 75-ohm coax. It's a very elegant solution. The dipole itself is a standard 80-meter dipole, same length as it would be, and the broadbanding is accomplished entirely by the transmission line. WBTGXM.
article on this broadband 80 meter dipole, where did you find that article, Rich? Was that part of the antenna handbook, so to speak? And the far end of the transmission line, was the shield going to one half the dipole and the semiconductor going to the other half? In other words, no balancing device was located at that point. OD Rich, K2IW.
Question first. There is a balun, a standard one-to-one balun, from the feed line to the antenna. That takes care of common modes to some extent. As for to the, it is the September 1993 QSD. It is by Frank Witt. It says AI1H, I think. WV2GX.
Yeah, that sounds like a very nice article. And I think an ordinary 80 meter dipole, the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio points cover what? Roughly 1/3 of the band or so, Rich, go ahead.
Yes, correct. A standard 80 meter dipole would not be able to span the entire band. You'd have to have an antenna tuner on it or have two different antennas. This particular article describes the system that you do not necessarily need an antenna tuner for the entire 80 meter band. It's very nice. WV2GXM.
And part of what's going on here is that every antenna, even though the books don't tell you that, they radiate, you resonate first, then it will radiate. So your 80 meter dipole has a certain length to it, and therefore electronically its half wavelength length is where it resonates, resonate being defined as at that frequency, no inductive reactance or capacitor reactance. It's a pure resistor somewhere. It might be a 73 ohm resistor, but it's a resistor. That's one of the definitions of resonance, where as you go to a higher frequency, you'll see an inductance. You go to a lower frequency, you'll see a capacitance. But at that frequency, the graph of reactance versus frequency goes through zero reactance. And that's one of the definitions of resonance. And therefore, you'll radiate very well there with a minimum amount of reflected power back down the transmission line. The craziness of the way impedance matching works is that when your mismatch is wrong in resistance, you get some reflected power. If your antenna was a 100 ohm resistor instead of a 50 ohm resistor, you get a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If your antenna was 100 ohms of inductive reactance along with its 50 ohms, you get a much bigger reflection coefficient. Reactance is a lot worse on a reflected signal. So you first try to get rid of the reactance, if you know what I mean. Okay, thank you for that information. Lou, NY2H, what would you like to talk about tonight, Lou? And which repeater is, how are you getting into the repeater tonight? NY2H, K2IW in the TechNet.
This is NY2H. Coming in on the Selden link, I had my house has some remodeling done, so I had to take the antenna off the roof. It's laying in the backyard, like on a 45-degree angle, but I'm close enough to Selden that it works to use Selden. So there you go. Let me let it drop. All right, I'd like to talk about, I guess last week there was some mention of frequency versus time domain and quadrature, delaying a signal a quarter of a wavelength. So I got to thinking, you know, SDR radio uses, I guess, an in-phase and quadrature signal, and between the two of them, they can do all sorts of demodulation and other tricks mathematically. So, knowing that if you have a single frequency, the delay for a quarter of a wavelength is absolute in time, and for example, you can use a delay line or whatever to generate a quadrature on that. Let me let it drop. But then I thought about these software defined radios and how they use the I and the Q, and they take not a single frequency but a bandwidth. So let's say you took 440 to 450 megahertz, for example, and they have an I and they have a Q. And then I said, well, if you'd use a delay line, that would only be quarter wave on a particular frequency, not a spread of frequencies. So I wondered how they did that. How do you generate the Q? Then I thought, what if you had heterodyne, you had a fixed local oscillator, say at 100 megahertz. Now, with a simple delay line for quarter wavelength, you could do that. So you could generate the I and the Q. And what if I heterodyned using the I, say, you know, with the output of an RF amp, say 440 to 450, and then use the other local oscillator, also at 100, but delayed by a quarter wavelength, would every frequency in that 440 to 450 bandwidth actually be delayed by its exact quarter wavelength?
In order to make this a little bit simpler, Lou, let's assume that I start off with a signal generator on my desired frequency, and I put that into a quadrature hybrid. A quadrature hybrid is a 3 dB hybrid. In other words, it's got two output connectors. Half the power comes out of each connector, but the two signals coming out are 90 degrees out of phase with each other. And if I take those two signals and put the, I call one signal the I, the in phase, and I call the other signal the Q, the quadrature phase, and which one I call which in some cases is arbitrary, but that there are two signals roughly 90 degrees apart coming out of the quadrature hybrid. And now if I have amplitude adjusters, the I signal goes through an amplitude adjuster, the Q signal goes through an amplitude adjuster, and then I take those two amplitude adjusted signals and recombine them with maybe a magic key hybrid or whatever, some kind of a combining device. Now by adjusting the amplitude of those two signals, and by the way, you'd like to be able to adjust them both in phase and out of phase. I won't get into that right now. So by adjusting those two amplitudes, I can reconstruct any kind of a signal I want on that frequency, any impedance match and so on. So once you have complete correction, picture a XY graph where the X-axis can be plus and minus and the Y-axis can be plus and minus. And by choosing the right amplitude of X and polarity of X and the right amplitude of Y and polarity of Y, I can put a dot on that graph anywhere on the screen that I want to. That's what these quadrature hybrid signal generator things look like. And you can do it in reverse. Let me drop this. If you take the input signal from the antenna and put it into a quadrature hybrid, and then the two output connectors, in phase and out of phase, you put that into a analog to digital converter. By finding the amount of digital in phase and the amount of digital quadrature phase of your incoming signal, you now can completely characterize that incoming signal. You can find out exactly its, you can reproduce its phase and amplitude, so to speak. So these quadrature signal generating and signal analyzing techniques work extremely well. The one I just described, the zero IF type of receiver, frequently uses that. For instance, the receiver that's on a RFID, what do you call it now, reading device, uses that technique. A pair of analog to digital converters on I and Q tell you everything about the incoming signal you want to generate. Now let me drop. In the ideal world, the I and the Q should be 90 degrees apart. And you're about to ask the question, if I go a little bit off in frequency, so if the I and Q are only 80 degrees apart instead of 90 degrees apart, can I still reconstruct that signal? And the answer, 99% of the time, is yes. There's a tiny little portion of the graph where you might not be able to get to because of your phase error not being exactly 90 degrees. But there's no exact rule that the quadrature has to be exactly 90 degrees. In the vicinity of 90 degrees, 99% of the time will do it for you, Lou. And by making yourself a graph of X and Y, where X and Y can be positive and negative, and you take the X and Y of the graph, and instead of the two lines being exactly at right angles to each other, make them at an 85-degree angle instead of a 90-degree angle, and you'll see that you can still reconstruct a dot almost anywhere on that screen that you want to, still by adjusting the correct amplitude of and polarity of X and Y. So 90 degrees is the most desirable. It doesn't have to be exact most of the time. NY2H, KQLIW in the TechNet. And by the way, I'm hearing you even on the input for the Sullivan repeater.
Okay. So, it sounds to me, I'm not familiar with how a quadrature hybrid splitting device actually works, but it sounds to me that it would be frequency dependent, that you'd get 90 degrees at a particular frequency, but as you go off frequency, it may revert down to 85 or what have you, as you say. So my question then is, if we took a local oscillator at a single frequency and called that the I, ran that through a delay line, quarter wave, so we still have the 100 megahertz oscillator. We have a second reference signal, which is a quarter wave out of phase from the first, and independently used the I and the Q of this local oscillator and mixed it with a band spread, say 440 to 450 megs on one instance against the local oscillator in phase, and we did the same thing with an independent 440, 450 coming in, and mix that with the quadrature local oscillator, then would every frequency in that bandwidth of 440 to 450 be exactly quadrature also? Would the math work out that way? And if that's so, that tells me that that's an effective way to avoid going off of the 90 degrees. And now we're not in the time domain, but in the frequency domain. I don't know if the math works out that way, but that's my question.
Yeah, it's very logical to create 90 degrees of phase shift between the I and the Q by using another quarter wavelength of transmission line. That's the simplistic way of looking at it. A quadrature hybrid doesn't do it by an extra wavelength of line in size. The construction of a quadrature hybrid automatically generates two signals that are at right angles to each other, one you call I and one you call Q. And a properly designed quadrature hybrid can be very broadband. I think it can be an octave broad where they are very close to plus or minus 90 degrees, plus or minus a couple of degrees of error across that octave of bandwidth. So a quadrature hybrid does it a lot more nicer than doing it with a transmission line. When you're doing it with transmission line, as you go to a higher frequency, your quarter wavelength of line is going to be longer than a quarter wavelength, and when you go to a lower frequency, it's going to be less. So you're going to get a predictable amount of phase error, which is not vital, which is not fatal, but you're going to get a predictable amount of phase error if you do it with length of transmission line. The quadrature hybrid is a much nicer way of doing it. When you do it with a quadrature hybrid into two amplitude adjusters, quite often that's a doubly balanced mixer. The nice thing about a doubly balanced mixer using an amplitude adjuster is that when you make the video signal go positive, you get one phase out, and when you make the video signal going into the doubly balanced mixer go negative, you get 180 degrees of phase. So that allows you to make a plus and minus amplitude adjusted signal. But the quadrature hybrid into a pair of doubly balanced mixers used as amplitude adjusters is called a vector signal generator, where you can make completely independent amplitude of the X signal and completely amplitude of the Y signal if you were graphing it on a polar chart, so to speak.
Repeater, timeout.
If you're doing it on a polar chart, it gives you some idea as to why they call it a vector signal generator. And when you're doing it as a zero IF receiver system, they call it a vector demodulator because it can independently treat the I and the Q. And when you properly high in the Q signal, you're doing a vector reconstruction. You can have complete control of the signal amplitude and phase, or when you're doing a vector demodulator on a on an RFID interrogator circuit or receiver, you know the exact characteristic of that signal. You could reconstruct that signal exactly because you know its amplitude and its phase. A vector demodulator tells you exactly the amplitude and phase of the signal. So studying a quadrature hybrid is a good way of studying vector generators and vector demodulators because it does a much purer job than using an extra quarter wavelength of cable. The quarter wavelength of cable is a logical conclusion as to how to do it, but a quadrature hybrid does a much nicer job. A quadrature hybrid built as a printed circuit really is a kind of directional coupler, is one way of doing it. And so where the extra quarter wavelength is coming from is not obvious. It's part of the electronics of what's going on inside there, Ralu. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, we may have doubled, and that's because sometimes I think the connection is a little flaky between the two repeaters. You're copying me now, correct?
I'm copying you beautifully, Lou. Go ahead. Sorry if I doubled with you. I guess I should have been listening on 975-375 to make sure I wasn't doubling.
Future hybrid sounds very intriguing and interesting, but I have a much simpler question. Let's boil down and let's focus on this. If I have a delay line at a specific frequency, there's no problem. So my specific frequency, I'm going to call the local oscillator. So we have that local oscillator. Let's say we have it at 100 megahertz. So through a simple delay line, I can develop a quadrature signal of that 100 megahertz. No problem. Smack 90 degrees. No issue. You know, given length. Now, I want to use the in-phase and the quadrature of the 100 megahertz as a local oscillator against some RF signals coming in. So my question is, are those RF signals, if I mix one with the in-phase local oscillator and the other with the quadrature local oscillator, will those resultant signals be 90 degrees out of phase? And if so, then it would be independent of the RF coming in. And I could do a whole bandwidth of quadrature using a single delay line because my delay line is on my fixed frequency local oscillator. I don't know if that works or doesn't work, and that's what I'm asking.
I'm pretty sure, Lou, the answer is it does work. The magic of a doubly balanced mixer is that if I shift the phase of the RF or shift the phase of the LO, the resultant signal that comes out gets shifted by the exact same number of degrees. That's the magic of a doubly of a mixer. A mixer obeys that. So yes, your fixed frequency, your LO, has got the 90-degree phase difference going to the two mixers, and now your RF you split and you put it into the two mixers. Or you can use it to give your phase shift of exactly 90 degrees of the mixed signal output. So the magic of a mixer, if I understand correctly, if I shift the phase of either the RF or the LO, the resultant signal that comes out has the exact same number of degrees of phase shift. If we're talking about fundamental mixing now, we're not using the second harmonic of the LO or the second harmonic of the RF. So as long as it's fundamental mixing, plus and minus mixing, the phase shift follows what you've done with the input signals. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That is independent of frequency. So if I have this 440 to 450 bandwidth, I could have 443, 448, whatever signal I want to look at, or all of them, would be in quadrature, 90 degrees. And you wouldn't retrograde down to 85 degrees or up to 95 degrees. You'd be smack on. I have a single length delay line, but the trick is it's in the local oscillator. And that's a fixed frequency. So I think, that would work, or that's how they do it. Because it's fantastic stuff, and as you say, you know, how you can pick out any aspect of the signal, they use different demodulations, you know, et cetera. So it's really, it's quite magical. Very good. Thank you for the information. I'm going to look up those cartridge hybrids too, because they sound interesting, and how they, like you say, they can take a whole octave with very little in the change of the shift. But okay, so sounds good. Thank you very much for the info, Dick. This is NY2H.
Yeah, I'm going to briefly describe a RFID interrogator receiver. The signal coming back down the antenna in the receiver, I put it into a power splitter. So I've got a whole bandwidth of signals. It might be 440 to 450 that I care about. The split signal goes into two separate mixers. The mixers are going to mix it down to an IF signal, maybe a zero IF. But the two separate mixers, one mixer has got an ILO, and one's got a QLO, by way of a quadrature hybrid or some other means. And so now, those two I and Q video signals coming out of those two mixers, acting as a zero IF system, I now do a dual polarity analog to digital conversion of I, and dual polarity, those plus or minus polarity conversion of the Q. And I'll get an exact answer across that whole bandwidth, as long as my power divider is equal on its phase across 440 to 450, and as long as the LO going into those two mixers are exactly 90 degrees out of phase, I now get a perfect answer out of that, if you know what I mean. So there is no additional phase error as a function of frequency when you do it that way. You've got it right. So by making the LOs, the phase shift, into the mixers, everything comes out correct with no phase errors. You've got it right, though, Lou, on that vector demodulator, and that's the exact technique that's used on a large number of the RFID interrogator receiver circuits. NY2H, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I do have a suggestion that next week, just as a suggestion, just to try it out, we do the entire TechNet in CW. Now, I'm only kidding, but thank you very much. Take care. NY2H.
Yeah, my next question is what CW speed would we use, what percentage of the listeners would get it, and so on. The nice thing about a zero IF system that's used on an awful lot of these RFID readers is that you're mixing down to a zero IF. It's a very simple system where the signal very rapidly in the beginning of the network, of the receiver, gets boiled down to a analog to digital signal. So you get a digital I and a digital Q signal, which you can now operate on. And it doesn't have a plus and minus. It doesn't have a image and a real signal. Everything you receive is on that exact frequency. In one step, you get a very narrow band receiver, if that's what you want, with only one frequency of response, no I and Q, no image in real, if you know what I mean. And so it works extremely well. The only thing you got a little bit of a problem with is having the right noise figure at the front end. But you can put a preamplifier on it. And a number of ham radio circuits have built zero IF systems, and the people were sometimes saying that, boy, is that a nice, quiet receiver. It's got some strong signal overload characteristics that are a little bit troubling at times, but by way of a step attenuator in the front end, you can handle that. Okay. We've got a couple of minutes left from the usual first hour of questions and answer. Is there anyone else who has a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2SHO, John in Los Alamos.
Go right ahead, John. And nice hearing from you again. And I think a fair amount of nuclear research goes on out there where you are. You got it, John.
Yeah, my apologies. I got to make sure I key up long enough. My apologies, Dick. My node ID'd right when you came back to me, so I missed almost all of that. Was there a question there, or was that just a handoff?
Yeah, that was sort of a question. I was saying, I think quite a bit of nuclear research goes on at Los Alamos, where you're located. But go right ahead with your question, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, that's correct. There is quite a bit of nuclear research here. And as I mentioned before, I work at the accelerator, you know, where they're taking nuclear particles and smashing them into things like spallation targets and things like that. And my question this week is has to do with the steering a bit of the beam. They use high magnetic fields to steer the beam around, which is interesting to me, but I don't know a whole lot about magnetics, and these high-powered magnets have very clear warnings, and you can't be near them when they're running. The effects on the human body are something that was a bit interesting to me to start to understand, even in the most basic. I was wondering maybe if we could discuss the effects of high magnetic fields on the human body. K2RW, KC2, SHO.
I think it's called the Faraday effect, where if you've got a strong magnetic field and you've got a conducting object moving at right angles to the magnetic field, you'll induce a voltage across the conducting object. I think that's Faraday's law. And that leads me to believe, although I've never read this exactly, that if you put your body into a very strong magnetic field, like in an MRI machine, you'll notice that they usually clamp down your head into a fixture and they move your body into the machine on this conveyor belt very slowly. It is my belief that if you, if while you're in the machine, if you're instance getting a head scan, and if you move your head back and forth rapidly, the brain material is it's got a lot of saline solution in there, your blood supply or whatever. It's a conductive medium, your brain. And in the strong magnetic field, if you move that brain rapidly back and forth, you'll be inducing voltages across portions of that brain. And I think you can give yourself a minor version of electroshock therapy if you moved your head very rapidly while it's in that machine. That's my belief. And I think that's part of the reason why they move you into the machine and out of the machine slowly, and they clamp your head down so you don't have a chance to move your head back and forth while you're in the machine. So that's my belief. So strong magnetic fields can have that effect on portions of your body where, by Faraday's law, you'll induce voltages if you move conductive material in that strong magnetic field at right angles to the magnetic field. So those are my beliefs on this one, Roy. And maybe we have some MRI people on frequency who will give us more information on this.
Repeater, timeout.
KC2SHO to take it with a delay in case we got anybody who'll give us more information. K2RIW in the TechNet. There's a delay, just got a job.
Hey, Dick. I was wondering if maybe Roy wanted to jump in there. Don't know if he's around tonight, but he sounds like someone who might have a good understanding of that. Well, that's interesting. The voltage, that wasn't what I was picturing. And I haven't read about this much. I only read, you know, basically the danger warnings. And you get a really quick kind of blurb about it during our safety trainings that we take here, but that wasn't what I was expecting as the answer. I was thinking more like iron in the blood or something like that. But again, I've read nothing on this, so I have no real clue at all. So I don't know if Roy's in there, if he wants to comment. I'd love to hear his take on it. Otherwise, thanks for the explanation, and back to you. EC2GS, if you're there, pick it up. Otherwise, K2RW, this is KC2, SHO.
C2GS here.
Go right ahead, Roy. And I'm pretty sure that they go through heroic efforts to make sure that there are no magnetic materials in that room with that MRI machine, because they could be sucked into the machine. The patient themselves, if they've got a heart pacer, I'll bet you there's some very extra precautions that have to be used, if the machine can be used at all with a person with a heart pacer. Make sure there's no magnetic materials on that patient you're about to put into that machine. And I, as you've heard me say, I made guesses as to why when they put you into the machine, they put you into it very slowly. AC2GS, tell us whatever we should know about an MRI machine, K2IW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick and John. Magnetic resonance imaging, it basically applies a very strong magnetic field and then turns on an RF energy field and measures a slight dip, like a grid dip meter, when the nucleus of a molecule reverse their magnetic spin in that mechanism. So you need multiple Tesla strong superconducting magnets to get this thing working. And it can cause problems. You can't put anything ferromagnetic anywhere near the damn thing because, you know, the magnet will just kind of suck it in. And if you're between the magnet and the piece of metal, it's going to go right through you, unfortunately. Iron isn't that much of a problem because not all iron is ferromagnetic, unfortunately, or fortunately. Actually, iron mostly is in hemoglobin in the human body, and some varieties of hemoglobin, deoxyhemoglobin, is a little diamagnetic, so it repels magnetic forces. So that's not the problem. As you mentioned, Dick, it's primarily Faraday's law, that you're inducing an electrical current by moving in a magnetic field or having the magnetic field change in intensity. That can induce currents, it can provoke seizures in some cases, but most likely it just leads to very strange sensations in a person in an MRI facility.
Now, when my wife had a MRI scan, at the end of the scan, she felt that she was slightly disoriented, and whether or not that was psychosomatic or real, we don't know. Have there been reported cases that you know of, Roy, where a person doing some kind of rapid motion while a portion of his body was in the strong magnetic field of an MRI machine where he did experience some peculiar effects? Have there been reports along those lines? And am I correct in guessing why they clamp your head down and move you on a conveyor belt slowly into the machine when you're introducing the patient into that magnet in order to minimize the Faraday voltage and current generating effects? AC2GS, K2IW.
It's always difficult kind of separating the anecdotal stories from anything legitimately scientific. There's a lot of other things that go on with MRIs, as you well know. A lot of them are closed MRIs. Now they're building more open MRIs, so there's a degree of claustrophobia. There's a big component of fear because you're not going for an MRI as a enjoyable trip someplace. And so there's a lot of other factors. But yes, I believe that it's very intentional to have that slow insertion rate to minimize any kind of eddy current because they're unpredictable. You don't know what you might trigger. If a person does have a tendency for a seizure disorder, you never know. You might trigger it that way.
Bravo Zulu.
Okay, Bravo Zulu. We should know, but please start off with your name and then your information, sir. K2IW, my name is Dick.
Dick, Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, my name is Rich. I just had an experience in an MRI machine where, I was going for an MRI, and I told the technician, a young girl, that I had a spinal cord stimulator trial, but I had them remove it because I didn't want to go forward with it. And she got all afraid that they left the leads in. And I told her, no, they took the leads out. I actually saw them in the hazardous waste bin. And so she said, I don't want to go through with the MRI. And it took a whole bunch of other machinations for me to finally get the MRI. And then when I got the MRI, I spoke, it was done by a seasoned technician who said that if you said they took them out and you saw them, that should have been good enough for her. I also, let me let it drop a second. Fortunately, I've had too many MRIs, and I never know when I'm going to get claustrophobic, and I never know when I'm not going to get claustrophobic. And that's sort of maddening. And I tell them, you know, right up front, I may or may not, you may have to pull me out, but usually once I sort of calm down, and I do CW in my head, by the way, and that always sort of works.